Dr. Allison Hull is a practicing dual board certified adult internist and pediatrician. As the founder and CEO of Wellbeing, Dr. Hull has been empowering patients, employees, and community organizations to optimize their health, prevent disease, and mitigate chronic conditions. As the creator of an award-winning corporate wellness program, Dr. Hull is a visionary seeking to transform the culture of companies and the lives within them. Her background and expertise in human nutrition, coupled with her passion for behavior change, has created the foundation for Dr. Hull to effectively educate each member of the Wellbeing tribe, so they in return can impact the lives around them. Most recently, she has become an associate professor at the University of South Florida, conducting research to solidify the metabolic effects of low carbohydrate and ketogenic nutrition, and more importantly, how to adopt and sustain this type of nutritional practice lifelong. It's an absolute pleasure to invite Dr. Allison Hull onto the show. Dr. Hull, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I've been so looking forward to this episode. I love my friends at Levels, Continuous Glucose Monitors. They introduced me to you and this amazing research you're doing, but it's just such a pleasure and I really appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure, Kelly. Any opportunity to kind of share our mutual passion, of course, and hopefully move the mark in the medical community to help people live better is a great day.
Yeah. So you have this amazing 12-week program. We're going to jump into that because you're doing some research with Levels and that. But, and just full disclosure, this is not a Levels sponsored podcast. This is just our love of glucose management and metabolic health and mitochondria and all that good stuff and hormones too. So you're going to learn a lot in this episode. I would love for you to introduce yourself, your background, and how you got started kind of down the road of blood sugar balance.
So yeah, I am a dual board certified adult internist and pediatrician. I've been practicing outside of residency almost 13 years, which is just nutty how fast it goes by. And my undergraduate degree was in food science and human nutrition from the University of Florida, go Gators. But of course, what I learned in undergrad and what I teach, promote, read, educate today is light years apart. So I've always had a passion for nutrition, utilizing that as a means of medicine for patients. But it wasn't until like my early onset of practice that it really came to a head. So two things happened. One, I graduated from my residency, and admittedly, I was heavily in the hospital for residency. I didn't get as much outpatient experience. So that really started in private practice. And I actually delivered my first child in my last year of residency at the very tail end. And come to find out, as a breastfeeding mom, he was not growing and thriving as he should have. And in the beginning, I was like, okay, well, he's just taking after me. I'm like 5 feet tall. I was kind of failure to thrive myself, and I didn't make too much of it. And then as time went on and he was unfortunately thriving even less with his weight, we started doing some more digging. And long story short, I was essentially poisoning my son with my breast milk because I was consuming dairy and he had a milk protein intolerance. And then later find out it's beyond a milk protein intolerance, but actually an anaphylactic allergy to dairy once he actually became exposed to it. So that started me down one path of like, whoa, like, okay, what's in our food? Because 30% of babies who have milk protein intolerance have soy intolerance. So now I'm starting to have to read every single food label as a breastfeeding mom because I'm like, all right, cool. I can cut out dairy, but now I have to cut out soy as well. And when you start reading those food labels and you're like, dang, soy is in every processed food. You can't even eat a piece of bread without soy. That started me kind of going down the rabbit hole of what's in food. And then couple that with, wow, every single patient I'm seeing in my office is obese and diabetic and hypertensive. And this low fat, low cholesterol phenomenon that we've been preaching is not working. So then I just did more research. Where did our dietary guidelines come from? What's this food pyramid we're talking about? And of course, it's all been like self-taught. And thankfully, we live in a world today where there's many like-minded people like ourselves. And now I've just been on a mission ever since. And it's been beautiful and it's been evolving. And now 13 years later, as a practicing physician, I now have the tools to truly heal and treat and prevent. And it's the most gratifying season of my life as a physician, because I have the ability to truly treat and heal people through food and coping mechanisms and stress resiliency and sleep and exercise and relationships, which is all a part of the well-being program.
It just hits me as a mom that your transformation, kind of that tipping point, that change and inflection in how you were practicing and how you practice today started in your home with your journey, with your breastfeeding journey and your child. I love that it comes with that much passion and in personal experience. I think it changes everything. It changes the game for us. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you work with your patients when a new child comes into your office or a new patient comes into your office. What are you looking at when it comes to health history, and what recommendations are you making?
Okay. So yes, I mean, it's funny because a lot of physicians don't even bring up nutrition, right? In the pediatric world, so I've got my pediatric world and my adult world. And in my pediatric world, it is a world I have to tread very lightly, right? When I'm looking at this growth curve with this parent, and honestly, the majority of even my pediatric patients today are overweight or even obese or morbidly obese. And so it's looking at that growth curve with that parent and wanting to educate and empower without judgment. Yeah. And, you know, and it's like, this is so important, but immediately as a parent, you go on the defense, right? And that's one of the beautiful things about the fact that I'm also an adult internist. I care for those adults as my patients too. The parents are my patients. So I can kind of hit it from the educational perspective of, we need to improve your health, your well-being, your nutrition. And oh, by the way, the byproduct of that is going to be now your child is going to eat so much healthier in the process. You know, research shows that I can talk to an adolescent or a teenager until they're blue in the face about what we need to do with your nutrition. But unless the parents change and model that behavior, it's never going to stick with a child or an adolescent. So it's an interesting dynamic. And of course, I've got a variety of different reasons why patients come to see me. And I certainly have those pediatric patients who come in with the, you know, the autoimmune processes, the eczema, the allergies, the asthma, the celiac patients, which, oh, by the way, I just have to pause on that because this was, gosh, I was in med school and it was probably my third year of med school. So this, we're talking like 17 years ago. I remember being in morning report. So this is, we would meet, you know, early before seeing all the patients in the hospital, and the most interesting case studies would be presented. Well, there was a case presented on this woman, long story short, has celiac. And it was like mind blowing that we have this woman with celiac that nobody's ever like seen or heard of celiac here in the United States. Fast forward 17 years later, and now one out of every 100 patients at least has celiac disease. Anyways, so then I'll also have patients who come in with attention deficit type of symptoms. And so it's always, okay, let's talk about our food history. What are we eating? And I typically do a workup with these patients too. Like, let's find an underlying root cause if we can, and that's through laboratory studies. But there's all sorts of different reasons why patients come to me that could be like food related, and it just depends on kind of the presenting symptoms and what we're trying to seek. But a lot of times the, you know, the just being overweight and obese, that's a difficult subject to have for sure.
Absolutely. Especially when you're seeing an increase in obesity in children, when you're seeing an increase in autoimmune diseases like celiac, when you're seeing those cognitive ADHD or ADD tendencies, getting to the root cause, getting to into their nutrition, understanding like what's happening in their home, how is their family eating? These are like really important topics. And you're actually doing a study right now around behavior change and what we can see in blood tests and results. Can you talk about this study that you're doing with Levels? What population are you working with? How does it work? And what have you seen in your results?
So what I love about Levels is it's like the perfect marriage, right? Because my two obsessions are the science of behavior change and then optimization of nutrition to prevent metabolic disease and everything that goes along with it. And, you know, that's one thing that has evolved over my years of practice is it kind of started with, okay, this is the ideal diet that we want to eat. But the problem is, you know, people tend to know what they should and should not eat, but it's really hard to adopt
to do it.
That's really where the money is at. And that's really where we need the quote magic pill, so to speak. So I just kind of started creating this like behavior kind of process. Okay, let's talk about our goals and how to create goals and what's the science of goal and habit formation. And in my experience with my patients and in the research, you know, it's all about having this immediate extrinsic reward mechanism to then bridge you to the intrinsic place of where I just eat this way simply because I feel good. And what's awesome about what Levels is doing is that CGM provides that real-time immediate feedback that creates that instant reward dopamine response that says, oh, dang it. You mean when I eat a salad for lunch, my glucose only went up 10 points as opposed to eating the pizza and it went up 50 points. So it creates self-awareness, right? We educate ourselves on what food does to us. And then, oh, now I have dopamine firing because I'm so excited to see this glucose response. So I want to do it again and again and again. And, you know, I mean, we can all prick our finger with a point of care finger stick glucose meter, but admittedly, that's a little bit more painful. It's a little bit more, you know, we're less likely to poke, 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 poke than we are to just swipe, swipe, swipe. So I do find that people also challenge themselves a little bit more with learning how different foods affect them. So they're going to push the boundaries and say, oh, okay, yeah, that's right. I should not eat the cupcake. Where I find when people just do the finger stick glucose, and we've saw this within the study participants, they wanted to make sure that that finger stick glucose was so meaningful that they weren't willing to challenge certain foods as much to learn then the good and the bad affiliated with food. So it provides that self-awareness. It gives you that reward mechanism. And then, you know, of course it's going to create the behavior change. And our whole goal within the study is to see if those utilizing the continuous glucose monitor with Levels Health not only have the better behavior change, but have better metabolic outcomes. And we're looking at a number of markers for that. So the obvious weight loss, right? We're looking at waist circumference, blood pressure. And then we're looking at a number of laboratory studies. So that's anywhere from insulin to lipid profiles, hemoglobin A1C, of course, the glucose response. And then something I'm really excited about is digging into the hunger hormones. So, you know, this is where I think it's growing in science, but we need more data to drive this, to really prove that low carb and even ketogenic nutrition, of course, affect those hunger hormones. And I always refer to low carb and ketogenic nutrition as gastric bypass surgery without the surgery because of the influence on those hunger hormones. So we're looking at leptin, ghrelin, PYY, glucagon, C-peptide, all these different hormones that dictate, you know, how hungry you are. So it's so interesting because people like get fearful of these low carb and ketogenic diets because they're like, oh my gosh, you might as well cut off my right hand because I'm not going to be able to eat this and that and that and that. But the feedback we get is, oh my gosh, there's so much freedom in eating this way because I'm not constantly hungry. So we need the more data, more science to move the medical community, to move the general public, to move our policies, to, you know, and that's the whole mission with myself and Dom D'Agostino and Levels Health.
I love it so much because it's exactly how I feel personally. And I've seen in my patients and clients as well, is it's that immediate, oh, please don't take this food away from me. But within 4 days, a week, it's this big, deep breath of, I can eat when I'm hungry without worrying about my waist size. I feel calm and relaxed. I'm not constantly thinking about food. I don't have that 3 or 4 p.m. crash. I sleep better. I have more energy. I'm feeling like spontaneously moving. Like all of these major positive changes happen, and it's getting over that hump. And I really do believe, like, and I'd love to hear more about the study, is that immediate reward system you're talking about, that Levels Health, when you take your phone to the CGM and you see, it only went up a couple points and this food is really great for my body and my blood glucose management. And that's going to keep that momentum and keep that change happening. So let's talk about some of the changes you have seen in exactly in this study in regards to all of those things, like waist circumference and where is the insulin level? Let's go through them one by one if you don't mind.
We don't have all the data back. We're still collecting it, especially the laboratory results. But as far as the weight loss, so the control group, which to define the control versus treatment. So both arms of the study went through my 12-week well-being program. And, you know, admittedly, I mean, it's a very well-formulated program that we do a touch in on, once again, that science of behavior change, even without a CGM. And then they follow a low carb or ketogenic nutritional path. So one arm is not using a CGM, but they are encouraged to use the finger stick glucose. So they're still getting feedback from the glucose, just not as consistently. The treatment arm, of course, wears the CGM. So the preliminary data that we have so far is we saw just shy of 8% of body weight loss in the treatment arm compared to 5% in the control arm. And then as far as waist circumference, there wasn't a significant difference there. So it was about 3.5 inches from both groups. Blood pressure, we actually, this is the joy of science, we actually saw a better improvement in the control group than we saw in the treatment group. But this is a small sample study, mind you. So, you know, statistical significance is more meaningful when we have a larger sample study. We had 30 participants in the study. Our next study that we're doing in January, we're bumping it up to 60. And our goal is to grow because it makes the data more meaningful. So that's what we're seeing from those initial markers. The area that I'm like really excited about is the fatty liver disease. So we're looking at ultrasound imaging pre and post program in that 12-week time frame at fatty liver. Thus far, we're still waiting on a few of the results to come back. We've seen 72% of all participants have resolution of their fatty liver disease in just 12 weeks. Higher proportionate of those are in the treatment arm, but we have, you know, saw that so far in the control group, but I can't give the exact numbers yet because we don't have them all.
I'm going to stop you for a second, if that's okay. Can you define, is the control group and the treatment group both following a low carb ketogenic diet and they both have access to their glucose, whether it's either they're using a continuous glucometer or they're using a finger prick glucometer that you would get, say, at a CVS, like a diabetic patient?
Yes, correct.
So I just want to make it very clear for the people listening that no matter which group you're in, you're following a prescriptive diet plan that would create an improvements in metabolic health, a decrease in A1C, a decrease in glucose, a decrease in insulin, obviously a beautiful resolution of fatty liver disease. You know, we're seeing this in the buildup. And would you explain how fatty liver disease is developed in children and adults? I think people immediately assume it's always alcohol. And so I would love for you to explain how this develops. I love that it's clearing up in 12 weeks. What a beautiful example of how the body is resilient and wants to heal.
Yes. And that's what's so amazing. And that's what motivates me so much is like, there's so much power behind this and people don't realize it. So once again, we need the science to move the mark, but okay. So fatty liver disease. So first of all, let me say that right now the stats are about 35% of the adult population in the industrialized world has fatty liver. And fatty liver is on a spectrum. So we have fatty liver, which is the beginning stages, and that's defined by 5 to 10% of the weight of the liver is comprised of fat. Okay, number two, we move to steatohepatitis, which is fatty liver with inflammation. And then we move over to fibrotic liver changes. And then the end stage is cirrhosis. And unfortunately, right now, the most common cause of end-stage liver disease and cirrhotic liver disease is fatty liver today. It is not alcohol. It is not hepatitis C. And as you just mentioned, I am seeing fatty liver in my pediatric patients. So this is another reason that it just really gets me fired up. How is it caused? So it's the term fatty liver, it makes people a little bit confused, right? Like, oh, it's because I'm eating too much fat, right? I'm eating too much fat. So the fat gets in the liver. No. What happens is it's all about the carbohydrates breaking down to glucose. When your body doesn't need to use that glucose, your liver and your muscles store glucose in the form of glycogen. There's only so much glycogen your muscles and your liver can store. So what happens is in that liver, when there's excess glucose and there's no more room for glycogen, it transfers that glucose into triglycerides, which is essentially fat. And that's where fatty liver disease comes from an excess amount of glucose, not from an excess amount of fat.
Did that answer your question? I love it. We're going to go a step deeper. So if someone is wanting, they understand now, okay, glucose comes from carbohydrates in the form of sugary, starchy, and liquid carbohydrates. The blood sugar goes up, insulin is released, it's picked up and it's put in your liver and your muscles. So what you're saying is there's no space left in my muscles and there's no space left in my liver for glucose stored as glycogen, then it needs to be converted to triglycerides or fat. So is the fat building up in the liver? Does it ever exit the liver? What happens there?
So this is what's so beautiful about a low-carbon ketogenic diet. What the whole premise of a ketogenic diet is to create ketone bodies from triglycerides, from fat. So you literally turn your fat in the liver into your fuel source. So that's how you rid the triglycerides within the liver, is because it's now turned into ketone bodies, which actually happens within the liver as well. And that's your alternative fuel source. And what's really cool too is even those participants that are following our low carbohydrate track, which we define that by 65 net grams of carbohydrates per day. And then it's 25% of their calories coming from protein. And then the rest of that comes from their fat intake. And it's all set based on their sex, height, and ideal body weight. But anyways, even those following the low carb, doing 65 net grams of carbohydrates a day, oftentimes enter into ketosis. And we know that because we have them checking blood ketone meters with Ketomojo, beta hydroxybutyrate. So sometimes just reducing the carbohydrate level to 65 will enter into ketosis. But then you couple that with, we do intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding, exercise. So all these kind of opportunities to intermittently enter in and out of ketosis. So yes. So essentially, when you follow a low-carb or ketogenic diet, your liver then takes those triglycerides and turns it into an alternative fuel source, which is why it's such a beautiful treatment for fatty liver.
I love it. You're basically giving your body a chance to be metabolically flexible, not always burning glucose or sugar, giving your body the chance to burn a fat substrate known as a ketone to empty that liver of stored fat and clear up fatty liver.
Yes. And then one of the key components of this, of course, as you know, is when you reduce insulin, then now all of a sudden we can activate lipase, which is the enzyme to break down fat. And so when insulin levels are chronically high, what happens is we lose the ability for the fat cells to break down fat. So breaking down that insulin resistance barrier through a low carbohydrate approach is key for weight loss. Now, this is, you know, what frustrates me, and I'm sure you as well, being in your world, is the whole calories in, calories out. It doesn't matter. It's the same thing. No, it does matter, because biochemically, how your body responds to glucose versus amino acids versus fat is very differently. It's way overly simplistic to just do this calories in, calories out, you know, methodology. We're very complex as a species. So let's give it value where its value is needed.
Oh, I love that. And you know, what's been so eye-opening to me is I spent a number of years using glucometers with clients, but now having a CGM with specific clients, it's been amazing to understand just how sensitive people are to specific carbohydrates. Like, I have a client who has a history of PCOS and infertility. And one of, you know, the most important thing for me was getting her on a CGM, really starting to understand some of those outliers, whether how she affected by caffeine, how is she affected by wine, how is she affected by things that, you know, are in her everyday life or that are touted as low carbohydrate, like a grain-free almond flour tortilla or something of that nature. And what's been really eye-opening to us is her response to stress and her response to some of these low carb ketogenic, you know, marketed products that aren't really working for her. And what we're seeing is, hey, you think these are low carb, but your body is not responding to it in that way. Your glucose is hitting a really high number. We see it in with your continuous glucose monitor. It's staying high, which is an indication that not only is your glucose staying high, your insulin's staying high. And of course, you're having a hard time losing weight. Of course, you're having a hard time breaking down the fat that's in your body. So many takeaways from a practical standpoint in my practice, and I'm sure you're seeing in yours, which is just priceless in my opinion.
Yeah, it's funny. What's wonderful is I have a lot of physicians in my group that go through the program. And I one in particular, he was like, oh my gosh, I never knew an apple would raise my glucose 50 points. So that's the other thing, right? As you mentioned, knowing how different foods affect you, how a sweet potato affects me might be different from you. And then also recognizing that foods that are, yes, healthy, but when we're really trying to optimize glucose and insulin control, we may have to admit some of these quote healthy foods like an apple. So that it is, it's just great feedback, such good information. So he doesn't eat apples anymore. Now he eats strawberries, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that what I think people assume is that having a continuous glucose monitor is going to make you feel really strict and like that you are on a diet and you can't eat things. But I actually find, and with my patients and clients, that it gives you so much flexibility. Like you were saying, you want to test foods. Like I never used to put a little honey in my vinaigrette because I was like, why would I ever add sugar to it? And when I had a CGM, I was like, you know what? I'll test this with my apple cider vinegar Cobb salad dressing. Let's just see, like, what does it do? And it's amazing the specific pairing of foods and what tolerances you might have that you kind of labeled. And I think it's blowing open my options and my ability to say like, okay, well, what can my body handle? When's the right time for me to do this? What can I do? I mean, a great example is that patient I was just mentioning. She's like, hey, look, I love wine and it really doesn't do that much to my glucose. But hey, by the way, when I go walk for 20 minutes after dinner, it's amazing how much better my fasting glucose is in the morning. And it's just a 20 or 30 minute walk with my husband around the neighborhood. Like these kind of things that get us moving and get us excited about change are just, I think, the most empowering part about CGMs.
Well, and yes, and I will kind of reiterate on that end, the whole stress response. So for me, you know, I've been following this low carb ketogenic path for a while now. So my glucose does stay pretty steady, although there's a couple of areas it does not. And one is the stress response. And so for me, it's very eye-opening when I'm like in this like frenzy of, you know, running on my treadmill of life. And I'm like, I check my glucose and it's not because I ate anything. It's because I'm in a tizzy. And it's like, all right, Allison, you got to practice what you preach. Now it's time to do your diaphragmatic breathing. And then, you know, I do a breathing session and then check my glucose and look at that. It's doing so much better. And yeah, we use it a lot with our participants too, asleep. Check your glucose after 5 hours of sleep the next day versus getting 8 hours of sleep. And there's such a difference. But I will also say, Kelly, for someone like me who's been so strict for so long, it opens my eyes as well that I also feel like it is important for us to have variability in our diet and to do some, you know, moments of carb cycling, because sometimes if we lower insulin too low for too long, we get this counter-regulatory hormone glucagon that tries to counterbalance. And now all of a sudden we've got this uptick of our liver producing glucose, gluconeogenesis. So I find for myself two areas. My fasting glucose levels are higher in the mornings, actually when I like my insulin levels too low for too long because of glucagon kicking in, creating glucose from the liver from a non-glucose form, which is coming from amino acids. It's coming from muscle mass.
Can we, right? I want to back that up because this is such an important topic for people to understand. What is gluconeogenesis? Where is it coming from? Is it from the protein we're eating? Is it muscle breakdown? Like, why would it be a disservice?
Yes. So gluconeogenesis, it takes place within the liver and it is taking amino acids and converting that into a glucose form. And then you'll see that rise in glucose. And then the counter that with glycogenolysis, which is the breakdown of glycogen into a glucose form. So those are two mechanisms that we can raise glucose without consuming glucose, right? So the liver making it through gluconeogenesis from amino acids, from muscle mass, and then glycogenolysis, which is the breakdown of glycogen within the muscles. So I find with myself, like I said, if I'm like too strict for too long, that I do see this glucagon kicks in, I start making glucose from a non-glucose form. And I really see that too with exercise. My highest glucose levels are when I exercise, when I run. I don't know if you see that, Kelly, but that's because my body's trying to make glucose from a non-glucose form. And that is multifactorial from the hepatic gluconeogenesis, but also from that glycogenolysis. And one of the arguments for a ketogenic diet with endurance sports or athletics is that you recycle lactate into glycogen to then be broken down into glucose. So you have this constant fuel source of glucose despite not consuming any glucose, which is beautiful because you don't need goo and Gatorade and all that kind of stuff when you're training. I've done marathons in ketosis and done beautifully. And that's because your body makes glucose from non-glucose form. But to back this all up, as I've been doing this and looking at, you know, my levels and then just talking with patients and doing the research, I do think that we benefit from variability within the diet. I feel my theory is that the body thrives best when it is seeking homeostasis. But as long as if we're in that homeostatic state for too long, just like lowering insulin levels for too long, the body's like, what's going on? I feel like I'm in starvation mode. Let me kick on that glucagon to counter-regulate. So it's one of my goals is to do a long-term study at a group of participants, you know, doing ketogenic long-term, and then others doing ketogenic with carb cycling in between and kind of checking those biomarkers and longevity markers as soon as we can have better longevity markers available. But that's kind of my theory. And when you look at the anthropological data, when we were hunters and gatherers and there was variability in the diet, we saw improvements in survival and evolution and things like that. So yeah, the human body is amazing.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Element, my favorite electrolyte drink. Element was developed by my friend Rob Wolf after he realized that a large group of people were probably living with electrolyte deficiencies and/or imbalances. Electrolyte deficiency can be the cause of headaches, cramps, fatigue, and weakness. And with the surge of low-carb, paleo, keto, and whole food diets, the body excretes more electrolytes at an increased rate, increasing the chances that you may have an electrolyte deficiency and need to supplement. Since the majority of sodium in our diet comes from processed foods, cleaning up your diet, fasting, or an increase in workouts where you sweat a lot can all cause this imbalance. The first time I drank Element, I felt immediately more alert and hydrated, literally like within minutes of drinking Element, and I've been drinking it ever since. They supported my hydration through my pregnancy with Toshin, and they completely rocked my milk supply. Meaning, yeah, I'm like, there's milk everywhere. I had always salted my food, but in hindsight, I know I had an electrolyte imbalance. If you're listening and you think, this could be me too, Rob is hooking my listeners up with a free sample pack. All you have to do is pay for shipping. And if you're in the United States, that means it's only $5. You can head to drinkelement.com/Kelly to snag the deal. That's drinkelement.com/Kelly to snag that free sample pack. All you have to do is pay for shipping and it's totally worth it. Go snag it.
Well, I love that too, because I do feel like if someone is low carb for too long or just in working with patients specifically, when you say, hey, this low carb ketogenic diet is great for metabolic health, it's great for brain health, it's great for all of these, you know, specific diagnostic markers or whatever it may be, people think, well, low carb's good, no carb's got to be the best. And it's exactly what we see. We see someone kind of throw themselves into this very restrictive plan. They want to control everything, quote unquote, be perfect, but the body always seems to fight back. It's going to fight back with hunger hormones. It's going to fight back with poor time sleeping. It's going to fight back with cravings. And so I love the idea of supporting blood sugar balance through your food choices and then having that flexibility and freedom to say like, hey, it's the weekend. Like, let's make some sweet potato fries in the air fryer. Let's like grab these. Like we have this place called Vetter's, which makes awesome coconut milk ice cream. And if it's post surf, we'll be like, all right, let's all go have one of these, like to have these joys of life, to have the celebrations. And again, this is where the CGM gives you flexibility because you can have those, you know, have that carb cycling and then say, look at the next day, is my blood sugar still elevated? Did it come back down? And you can see how resilient the body is in bringing it back down, but also fueling your muscles and your liver right back up.
Yeah. And I think the key is carb cycling with real whole foods and not let it be like, this is my ticket for
glucose. Yeah. Right. No.
Oh, and you know, but this is a beautiful thing too. A lot of times when people, you know, follow these changes and really commit to it, they feel so amazing eventually that when they have that cheat meal, they're like, oh, dang, I'm not going to do that again for a really long time. So that's when that intrinsic motivation comes into play. You know, my husband, who he, after me doing this for a number of years, and he always ate pretty healthfully, but I was like, honey, can you really like commit to the 12 weeks, you know, really do it. And he did. And he lost 30 pounds and he feels amazing. And then there was one, you know, New Year's Eve where he didn't follow the plan. And he's like, oh gosh, that's it. I'm never doing that again. So I think that's what happens. And then yes, the splurge becomes sweet potatoes as opposed to Twinkies and a donut or Pop-Tarts or whatever. So yes.
No, it's true. And those setbacks are just reminders. And sometimes we need those setbacks like your husband had. And, you know, admittedly, like that's how it works with everybody. It's to think that you're going to be strict, quote unquote, perfect, or try to control everything. That's not reality, but we all need to level up and we need to pair what you're saying, what you're an expertise in, those behavior changes with nutrition to see the benefits. Can you walk me through your 12-week program and what each one of the steps entails and what you're attacking to support metabolic health and behavior change?
Yes, beautiful. So it is 12 weeks and it's one session per week. And we have a live class that I teach in person and then virtual. So you can be anywhere in the world, which we have people actually in different countries participating. And every week is a different subject. And it's very strategic, this kind of lineup that we take. So week one, we talk about the starting line measurements and identifying that ideal human diet. So what is the history of our species on planet Earth? And what did we eat for millennia to be the dominant species on planet Earth? So we just want to educate them on just the background. And then week two, we start into the behavior change and we couple gut healing with goal setting. So, and there's a reason why we couple the two together. As you know, the gut, so vital, so important. And if we can start healing the gut early on in the whole process, people are going to be set up for success much more greatly because of those neurotransmitters, right? Serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine that are created and housed within the gut system. So we talk about gut health and what that really means. And then we couple that with goal setting. So we talk about the science of behavior change, the whole dopamine response and habit formation. And then week three, we move to what we call mastering detours. So we're trying to help people use different behaviors other than food as our coping mechanism, as our reward, as our stress relief, you fill in the blank, right? So we say, okay, what's your detour? So instead of going to the pantry at, you know, 9:30 at night after your kids go to bed and you're like, oh, I'm gonna reward myself for the day, or I have this work to do and this project to finish, so I'm gonna, you know, eat my emotions and food, what's your detour? So we teach them other behavior tools. So whether it be journaling or diaphragmatic breathing or, you know, texting a friend, praying, meditating. So detours and then debunking the mystery of our dietary guidelines. So that's week three together. So what is this food pyramid? Where did it come from? Why is it really meaningless? And then week four, we move into nutritional ketosis. What is ketosis? What does it mean? What's the science behind it? Because there's so much wrong misinformation about a ketogenic diet. So we try to explain the right information. And then week five, we move into choosing your path, the low carb path versus the ketogenic. What does each path look like? How do we define it? Week six, we then talk about what's called tracking and navigating your plan. So another behavior modification tool we use is just food tracking. We utilize the Chronometer app.
Love it.
Yep, the weigh, count, measure, put everything in, which is always so eye-opening. Oh my gosh, you mean that's a serving size? Who would have thunk that, right? And oh, I never realized there were so many carbohydrates in a bowl of oatmeal. So we have them weigh, count, measure, track. How do we like live life in this realm? And then week seven, we move into fasting or time-restricted feeding. Week eight, we talk about fitness. But we talk about fitness from a different perspective. Everybody kind of thinks about fitness and, you know, building muscles and looking good in the bathing suit, but we really approach it from the cognitive enhancement, the immune response, right? The more kind of like cerebral benefits that we get from exercise that a lot of people don't realize. And then week nine is sleep, such an undervalued component of our well-being. We live in a society, right, where It's a badge of honor to get that 5 hours of sleep a night, right? And I always say, you might as well eat the box of donuts. I mean, it's as bad as eating the donuts, guys. And then week 10 is, we actually, it's in the kitchen, and we teach them how to cook healthfully, quickly, affordably, deliciously. As a working mom like you, like, we got to get creative. We got to do some cooking. And then week 11 is food as medicine. And really we harp on phytonutrients and phytochemicals and antioxidants, and really looking at food with a whole new lens. Like, I want to eat the spinach because it's going to give years of value to my life, not because it's a sacrificial event. And then we talk about gluten in that week too, and kind of explaining, you know, why there's so many people with this gluten sensitivity today. And then we end it with finish line measurements and what we call leading the way. And the leading the way piece is so important, because this is where people now take on that leadership position where, okay, I'm now going to welcome somebody else into the tribe and lead them, because the research shows that we're going to be much more likely to sustain behavior change if we're a part of an accountability group. And that is why the program is called Well-Being, a Tribe Planted with Purpose. So we're a tribe, we're a community, we support one another. And the planted with purpose stems from, we have to have a foundational driving force to stay the course. A big motivator for me, a big piece of inspiration, two books. One was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, and then Tribe by Sebastian Younger. And which he has a new book out yet, which I haven't read yet, but the two, you know, really kind of merge together in that we as humans, oh my gosh, we're capable of anything if we have an underlying purpose. And typically when that purpose extends beyond ourselves and we're part of something bigger than ourselves, it's magic. And so that's a lot of what we teach in the first few weeks, is identifying that purpose, right? Fostering that purpose, watching it grow. Yeah, that's the 12 weeks in a nutshell.
I cannot tell you how much I love that it is tribal. The book Tribe by Sebastian Younger, that's one of the reasons why we named Sebastian, my son, Sebastian, because it kept coming up for us. San Sebastian is my husband's and my favorite place. He's the saint of athletes. And then Chris read that book Tribe and then passed it on to me, and I read it. And it's just, it's what we search for, right? We search for that community. We want to do things together. That's why I think making it a part of the program to bring someone in is so, so important. And I can't tell you how much it means to me to hear that is a part of your program, because it is. The minute you're coaching someone else or helping someone else, you are now responsible for their health. And I think as moms having children and looking at it in that way and feeding our family and feeding our kids in a specific way is honestly just reinforcing our own behaviors and creating that generational change, which is so amazing. It's such a comprehensive program, Allison. I can't tell you, like, I'm looking at it, I'm looking at all 12 weeks, and there's nothing that I would have put in the program outside of what you've discussed. And I just think it's really important. One of the things I want to highlight is you talked about in week 5, choosing a low carbohydrate or ketogenic plan. And I did notice in your notes, it's a Mediterranean ketogenic plan. And I'd love for you to kind of touch on what the difference is between a Mediterranean ketogenic plan and kind of what you're seeing when people come to you.
Yes. So, I mean, a lot of times that knee-jerk reaction of, oh, it's keto, is like, you know, bacon and cheese. Right. That is not what we're going for. There's no bacon or even cheese on the menu. If people are going to consume dairy, which you know as well, like, I'm not even sure that's meant to be in our human diet. When you look at the history of the Homo sapien diet, it didn't come into the forefront until about 5,000 years ago. And that's because with the agricultural revolution, our crops failed and we needed to feed our, you know, our children. So let's give them some cow's milk. All right, moving on. So it is not a bacon and cheese fest. It is first and foremost greens. So I didn't explain this in the 12 weeks, but in the 12-week process, every week it's an incremental change. So that's the other thing. A lot of times when people want to make a diet change, they want to rip it off like a Band-Aid, change everything overnight. They feel like crap because now they have keto flu or whatever else is going on. That's not going to reap success. So every week we build. And part of that building process is week one, it's, all right, you got to get 2 servings of something green. And then by week 5, you're eating 6 to 8 servings of non-starchy vegetables a day. 6 to 8 servings a day. First and foremost, on your plate is something green. Now, of course, it could be a red pepper and yellow squash, whatever. But I use that term, green. Then let's talk about the fat. I want the fat sources coming from olive oil, avocado, avocado oil, salmon, nuts, seeds. Okay, we can have some, you know, free-range eggs and grass-fed beef in there, but you're going to be practically drinking olive oil because the polyphenols in that thing are amazing, okay? So next is we specifically incrementally increase those fats as well. We explain what the fats are, what's a serving size, and every week we build on the fats. And then the proteins, it is not a high-protein diet. It's an adequate protein diet. It is a protein amount that is, you know, going to provide ongoing repair and growth, but by no means is it excess protein. So we define all that.
Do you have like a gram per kilogram or gram per pound that you kind of aim for? Yeah.
So for the protein goals, it's 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of ideal body weight. So ideal. And we typically recommend those who are more sedentary, so some of my older patients or participants, to stick to the 1 gram per kilogram of ideal body weight, or if they have chronic kidney disease, 1 per kilogram per body weight. But if you're active and exercising, then we typically recommend the 1.5 gram per kilogram of ideal body weight. And that equates to 25% of their total macronutrient intake. Now, I will say, depending upon how things are going with the participant, we may fluctuate protein a little bit. So if we're having someone have a difficult time entering into ketosis or staying into ketosis and they're doing everything right otherwise, we'll sometimes lower the protein goals for that individual.
I love it. Just really great information for people if they are wanting to get started. Obviously, your program is online and they can join the tribe, which I think makes a major difference in accountability and actually getting the job done. But also mentioning the fact that you want people starting slow. It is knee-jerk reaction to want to rip the Band-Aid off, but it doesn't last. And we're building foundational change with this or any type of program where it's looking at, hey, this is a more of a long-term thing. If you really want to be doing this and you see it in week 8, moving for life, like thinking about moving, like, can you be doing these activities in your 60s, your 70s, your 80s? Are you going to stay, you're going to keep moving in that way. And I love that. You touched on protein. Can we touch on the optimal human diet a little bit more? Because when it comes to raising our kids, you know, there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of kids' foods that are, you mentioned dairy, but can we go into the amount of grains and processed foods and packaged foods that are in lunchboxes, offered to children? How are you feeding your kids? And as a pediatrician, how are you recommending that kids eat?
Oh, I know. This is, and honestly, I sometimes lay awake at night about, like, still struggling about even what my own kids are eating. And it's even been an evolution in my own household with my children. But yeah, let's talk about gluten. First of all, it should be, once again, a garnish. It should be like parsley. When you look at the history of the Homo sapien diet, I mean, wheat was grown in between rocks, and you would just randomly come across it. You know, it is now the average American eats 197 pounds of wheat per year. As you know, it's in our cereal for breakfast. It's in our sandwich for lunch. It's in our goldfish crackers for snack time. It's in our pasta for dinner. Like, that is a huge reason why we're seeing this dramatic uptick in whether it's celiac or gluten sensitivity. It's the volume of which we eat it. And it's also, of course, the hybridization of the wheat molecule itself. It's not even the type of wheat we're supposed to be consuming. Okay, so it is a problem. And so for my own children, so we have done periods of strict gluten-free over the years. Right now, I would say we're probably more of a strict gluten limitation. I don't really have it in the house. I mean, it's crazy, Kelly.
Everywhere.
I mean, so my son, who's now in sixth grade, I went to the orientation and they were like, okay, so which why we even have a snack rotation in sixth grade is beyond me. But for this thing he has, we're supposed to do like rotating snack, like whatever. And so the parent asked, what snacks do most parents bring? And the teacher said, donuts. And I'm like, for the love of Pete, really, do we have to give our kids donut for snack time in sixth grade? I mean, they're inundated. And even if we do everything right at home, my kids go to school, they go to friends' houses, they go to birthday parties, like they're going to eat gluten. I'm not going to lie. They're not overly sensitive to gluten, but partly because we probably limit it at home. But in the home, we don't have it. So I, for my children, I don't feed them starches at dinner time. So I don't really do rice or potatoes or things like that. We do fruit and proteins because I know they're getting some of those starches at lunchtime at school. And then for breakfast, you know, admittedly, it's a challenge with my younger who's 10, but we get creative with smoothies. Of course, we do eggs. Sometimes we do like, you know, dinner-ish items for breakfast. You just kind of have to like think outside the box. But a funny little story, just so everybody can relate, that I'm same like space you are with the trials and tribulations. This was, gosh, I want to say about 4 years ago, my husband actually took my kids to their pediatric appointment and the pediatrician asked my son what his favorite vegetable was. And his response was a hot dog. It is an Applegate hot dog, but nonetheless, I mean, my 10-year-old who's now 10, like getting vegetables with him, it is a battle, but you know, it's a battle worth fighting. So I do little things like the first thing on your plate is the green thing and you don't get anything else until you eat the green thing. Right. And over the years, he's definitely gotten better. My 12-year-old is much better than my 10-year-old, but I understand it's hard. And then oftentimes my husband is not completely on the same wavelength as I am, and he doesn't find it as important as I do. So then there's that back and forth. So this is my expertise, and yet I still struggle like the rest of you out there. So I can share in your pain.
Yeah, no, I think it sounds like we have mirroring lives a little bit, because my husband, my Instagram handle is Be Well by Kelly. My husband is Be Bad by Chris. Because he likes the pizza and the fried things. And he's like, I grew up eating the entire tub from Costco of vanilla ice cream and a whole loaf of sourdough with peanut butter on it and help myself to the cereal. And again, like when Chris and I first got together, it would be, he would finish a box of cereal after dinner when we were together and with real milk. And it's like looking at him now, there are no cereal boxes in our house. There's no gallon of milk in our house. He has, you know, if he has those cravings after dinner, it's like he'll open the jar of peanut butter and throw some like Lily's chocolate chips on top and he's okay. But it is like it's change over a long period of time, but you have to look at that long run and you have to keep trying with your kids because it is, I mean, the struggle is real. Like it is, it's so much easier to control with your kids or like offer them up those foods when school isn't a thing. And you know, Bash went to school, I'm dealing with the same issues. I had to take a picture of the snack calendar and it's like Cheez-Its and juice. And I'm like, First of all, what? Like this is a processed glucose spike. And then you're going to skyrocket his glucose with juice. And I mean, I put it in our health history. I was like, we don't do any liquid sugar in our house. There won't be juice and there won't be coconut water and there won't be like, he won't be drinking milk. So it is so much more work as a mom. I'm bringing him electrolyte packets that they can, you know, that he can put in his water when they all have juice and giving him his little baggie of crackers to go into school. And you can't change everything, but when I can, I'm putting in the effort because exactly what you said, it's like, if we don't lay the foundation now, and they're going to fight back. I'm sure you got to ages where they're like, no, mom, I'm not eating that. I'm not, it's going to be a battle. It's going to be a fight. But just to say like, don't give up, don't give up, right. Don't give up, don't give up. Cause I do feel like at a certain point they come back around and they go, oh yeah, this is really good. I want to be involved in this. This is exciting. Like, how do I eat this way? And they'll have those benefits that adults have of, I feel better. Do you ever make associations for your kids when they have the freedom to say, eat the cupcake, have the Gatorade, do the thing, and they don't feel great after? Are you highlighting those with your kids? How are you having conversations around food with your, because I feel like your kids are older, obviously older than mine, and able to have those conversations.
Yeah. One night we went out to dinner and my younger one ordered some type of, you know, dessert. It was like a brownie sundae thing. He ended up vomiting that night. And so actually, number one, he was like, oh, that was no fun. And then my older one was like, remember when you had that? Let's never do that again. So, because my older one does not like the thought of vomiting, anyone else vomiting. So
definitely don't.
Yeah. whole, you know, hangry situation. Like, so it typically happens, right? If you eat a higher like carbohydrate meal snack, and then an hour later, you're hangry and starving. So we definitely talk about that. And then, you know, what I try to employ at home, and what I always tell my families in my practice, is we can't force them to eat the broccoli and salmon. Where we have control is not making those unhealthy foods available. So at the very least in your household, if you don't have the chips and the crackers and the cookies available, well, that's a huge step in the right direction. And they're going to grope and moan over the fact that you don't have chips and cookies available. But guess what? It will eventually become the new norm. Change is always hard, no matter what age you are. But once again, just keep fighting the battle. It will be worth it. Their palate will adapt, right? Their habits will adapt, and they will start associating, like, I feel better when I eat this. It's so funny because every Wednesday night, I make salmon, and my kids are always like, oh, salmon again. Yep. Salmon again. Yep. My friend. And they,
every Wednesday. Yep. My friend.
but they eat it all. They eat it up. It's so funny. And I'm like, why do you complain when you actually do love it and go back for seconds? So we kind of, you know, joke on that. And then of course, when we go out to eat, of course, I'm always eating things like salmon. And then they're starting to make more of their choices in that department. And then what ends up happening is they come over to my plate and they start eating my food. So yes, it's not going to happen overnight. And I think that's part of the problem, is parents are like, okay, I want to make a change, but it's so overwhelming. What do I do? Okay, let's start with just removing certain things from the house, right? Let's start adding more things into the house. Let's lead by example, right? So I think, don't think that you're going to make a change overnight, but then also, if you don't give up, even though there's going to be a hiccup, don't give up, even though they're going to complain, right? Parenting is hard. Like, all the things we do as a parent that they don't like, but is in their best interest, this is one of the most important missions we have as a parent. So just keep fighting.
I really can't thank you enough for that like pep talk, because it really is exposure, and it's consistency, and it's modeling. And it's so easy to start to feel broken down as a parent, backtrack. And you've got to recommit, because it's exactly what you say. I mean, Bash, our little Sebastian, is at the age now where he's tall enough to reach the fridge doors and the pantry cabinet handles. And before, it would be something where I'd say, hey, it is snack time. You're 18 months old or you're 2 years old. What do you want? Here are the options. I have some berries. I have some nuts. I have like some leftover chicken from last night. There's, you know, dips like Primal Kitchen Ranch. You can dip your chicken in the ranch. Like, I always kind of give him, yep, I guess, like power and agency, yes, in healthy decision-making. Yes. But I'm not going to be like, and then there's this. Well, the minute he became old enough to then start opening the fridge and the cabinet, that will hold you accountable. That's where I had to tell Chris, like, hey, if you're going to have Siete chips, which are great, awesome, grain-free, like, we're ordering those from Thrive Market, they're coming, we actually need to put them in the upper cabinet, because he's opening those cabinets and going like, I want that for snack. And so that's exactly what you, like, I love that you brought that up, just giving them that freedom, but also not having those options around, because on those hard days, it's really hard to say no. It's, I say it again and again, but you either make one decision at the store not to bring it in, or you make 20 decisions in the house to try and not eat it.
And I love what you said too about giving them options. I think for all of us, we always want to feel like we're in control, and kids are no exception to that. So if they feel there's some autonomy in the decision-making process, have them be a part of the meal planning and the grocery shopping and the preparation, the, you know, growing some vegetables out back, you know. I mean, it's funny. I always have a few little, I don't have a big garden, but a few things growing at a time. And my kids will go out there and, you know, take a bite of something that they probably wouldn't of just naturally done otherwise, but having them be a part of it, I think, is really helpful. But yeah, it's a battle we're fighting for. And I know for me in my house, sometimes my kids will be like, there's nothing to eat. And I'm like, great, then don't eat. And honestly, and I think that's something as parents too, like, we freak out if they go, you know, an afternoon without a snack, or they don't eat that much for lunchtime, they're going to be okay. Right. And I'd rather them have nothing to eat than have nutrient depleting food like Goldfish crackers. And the more we can kind of stick to that, once again, the more their palate will adapt, their behaviors will adapt. And now they'll be like, okay, I am going to eat the pistachios as a snack because there's no cookies and chips. So I'm going to just go ahead and have this instead. Yes, it's just, it's grinning and bearing it and being faithful, but good will come.
I love it. One more thing before we close up today, because I know I've taken so much of your time already. I'm so excited. I kind of want to go take the 12-week program and just see what you guys are teaching alongside with my CGM. I just, if people are interested in levels, levels.link/Kelly helps you skip the line. I'll also put Allison's link to her program in the show notes. But I would like to talk a little bit about what you've seen with plant-based eating and a CGM or plant-based eating with kids. I know this isn't something we talked about, but as a pediatrician, what are your recommendations? Because I do have clients that come to me and they want to feed their kids a plant-based diet or their kids aren't eating protein, animal proteins. What recommendations do you have for parents who are kind of dealing with kids who don't want to eat animal-based protein? Or what are your recommendations if the parents want to feed their children that way?
I know. So number one, let's talk about the parents who are vegetarian or vegan. That's another area that's kind of difficult to like tread because I don't want to place judgment. A lot of times people have their very kind of laundry list of reasons why they want to feed their children this way or they want to eat this way. But I do kind of give my little kind of spiel on the history of the Homo sapien diet and, you know, and how animal protein is a big part of the evolution of the human brain and fetal development, if they'll, you know, kind of listen to me. But because there's variable reasons why people avoid animal proteins, then we just have to make sure we're getting proteins, you know, from other sources. So, you know, it's tough if they don't eat things like nuts or seeds or legumes, which a lot of times, if it's simply because they're a picky eater, then they won't eat nuts and legumes, and they're now just living on pasta and, you know, grilled cheese sandwiches and Pop-Tarts. In those extreme situations, when it's really because of a picky eater, I actually recommend feeding therapy. I think this is something that's missed a lot. There's picky eating, and then there's true like sensory aversion. And this is where you can't rationalize with the child to, you know, take a bite of X, Y, or Z because they have such a phobia, this immediate like choking gag response, that it's going to take a third party to get this child to actually try different types of foods, including animal proteins. So I've had a lot of success with speech therapists doing feeding therapy with my kids who have very significant, you know, food sensitivities or with different types of foods, including animal protein. And then, you know, I do find if they're for the younger population, sometimes it's just the fact that the animal protein is like the texture of it. It's very chewy. So I get a lot of success with salmon and just fish in general because it's softer. They tend to tolerate it better with eating that way. So yeah, so it's kind of a case by case scenario based on what's the reasoning. Is it, you know, just the family, the parents don't want them eating animal protein versus the kid is picky about it, a food kind of sensitivity. So then I just have to approach it differently in that way.
I love that. Yeah, that's something that has been a really difficult topic for me. And something that in my second book, Body Love Every Day, I wrote a plan for adults to live a blood sugar balanced lifestyle with plant-based proteins and kind of highlighted how maybe the rice and the beans is a major glucose yep. spike that they're unable to really metabolize all of that in one sitting. And if we're having the beans, we're leaning on those non-starchy vegetables. But as I moved into nutrition for pregnancy and for children, I kind of went back to my roots, looking at the research in where are these kids getting things like choline, iron, long chain omega-3s, like what nutrients are most important for cognitive development in utero, fetal development, and then cognitive development for children. And I'm having those conversations too. So I was just looking for a little expertise from you as a pediatrician in that space, just because it's one thing to look at blood sugar management with adults and on a vegetarian diet who've made a decision to do that. But I think our children are relying on us, I think, really to be the adult in the room and provide them with the most nutrient dense foods, to provide them to provide a safe space for them at home to choose their snacks without you know, having a gluten bomb or a dairy bomb if they don't necessarily need those things. So I just can't thank you enough for your time, Dr. Hull, and for doing, you know, having such an amazing program that is seeing such great results. I can't wait to see the results on the hunger hormones, because that's something I love to geek out on as well. Like, why would we, if we can eat a diet that doesn't make us feel hungry and hangry, why wouldn't we reap the rewards of that, that also give us all this metabolic flexibility and just make us feel our best. So thank you so much for your time and lending us even more than I had asked for. But where can people follow along? Where can they find you? Where can they find the 12-week program and their tribe?
Beautiful. Yes. Our website is yourwellbeingtribe.com. And then you can also follow me on Instagram at Dr. Allison Hull. You know, we love to grow our tribe. It is a mission and truly a ministry for myself and my team. It is quite frankly, one of my primary purposes on planet Earth. So it just brings me so much joy and purpose. So I appreciate this opportunity, Kelly, to get the word out there for you and I to have our kind of joint mission here. So thank you.
My pleasure. I'm so excited about the comprehensive program and all that you're doing. It really, you're helping the parents change, which then also helps our next generation and these lovely little children go do big, wonderful things to change the world. So it's a big mission, and I'm so happy that you're doing it and can't wait for people to tune in and join. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.